This will be the first surah in the Quran, the Fatiha. Glory to God Most High, full of grace and mercy. He created all, including man. To man he gave a special place in his creation. He honored man to be his agent, and to that end endued him with understanding, purified his affections, and gave him spiritual insight, so that man should undertake and understand nature, understand himself, and know God through his wondrous signs, and glorify him in truth, reverence, and unity. The Quran is meant to be listened to, not to be read silently, but to be listened to. And in fact, the Quran is not meant to be read, but to be recited from memory and in a proper mode. One who would be a reciter of the Quran would be honored in our tents always. Notice the similarity between a reciter of the Quran and a reciter, for instance, of Homer. Here in the methodology and in the technique is more than just a sheer parallel, but is a continuance of an ancient tradition. The Quran is an epic. It is an epic, though, not of man's actions on this world, but of God's actions towards man. The integrity of the reciting of the Quran with the reciting of Homeric epic is just one major structure of similarity, and there are many others. The most poignant is the way in which sacred hymns are used, and each surah of the Quran is itself a sacred hymn or a sacred poem. And these are exactly in line with the technique that those who have been coming to Tuesday nights for so many months and several years now understand as the basic process by which consciousness is trained. And in fact, the listening to the human voice in a structured format, in a concentrated hearing, is exactly the ancient tradition of developing the mind. The mind in terms of consciousness, in terms of memory. In fact, the very process that we have here is consonant with the ancient tradition. Our coming together with the periodicity, and there is actually no necessary periodicity, we are simply used to a 7-day cycle. All of us, and coming together once a week to listen in a concentrated way to a human voice speak of high consciousness is exactly the archetypal traditional form of prayer and of religious endeavor. Whether it is the sermon in a Protestant ceremony on a Sunday, or it is the ritual form of the Mass, or it is the hearing of the Quran, or it is the reciting of passages from the law in a synagogue, all of these share the same archetype. They all come under the same aegis, and that is the training of consciousness of the mind. Now we have today a special interspace between one whole section of our inquiry and another, between the 3 months that are devoted to magic and the 3 months that are devoted to art. And as the interspace, as the significator for the interspace, I'm using Ibn Arabi, one of his short texts, Journey to the Lord of Power, which has come out in several translations, and it's subentitled A Sufi Manual on Retreat. Now, the only use that high spiritual sources have, the only use that high spiritual sources have, is to articulate experience. They do not add content. High spiritual sources are different from intellectual or psychic or mythic sources. They do not add content. They articulate form. They give the portioning out breathing spaces. They give the rhythm of apperception. They give the cycles of conception. They designate for us how we space and order and structure and pace ourselves, so that high spiritual teachings essentially do not have a content. Whatever content is there is gratis and incidental, actually. Their true function is to acquaint us with the articulate structuring of our consciousness, of our experience, of the previously experienced content, of the previously developed meaning. If you do not have the content and the meaning, if you're not full, high spiritual teaching goes through you like a very high form of radiation and nothing registers. For if you have nothing to arrange, then the signal for arranging passes you by. Colloquially put, many are called, few are chosen. In actual essence, all are called. In our Saturday form, our coming together every morning is an archetypal religious experience. But its religious content is not that of a single sacred tradition, but is an acquaintance, a précis of all of the spiritual traditions that have arisen on the planet. And not just an ecumenical smorgasbord, but brought together in an actual articulate structure, which is archetypally traditional and would be recognized by someone in Christianity, by someone in Islam, by someone in Judaism. There are many different ways of appreciating the structuring and the form. So this week, today, we have Ibn Arabi, The Journey to the Lord of Power, and it is a high spiritual teaching. The content is not given here specifically. What is given here is a method of articulation. Now, we have a wonderful opportunity to appreciate, as a little bit of background, a couple of paragraphs from a book published by the Bollingen Foundation, Creative Imagination in the Sufism of Ibn Arabi by Henri Corbin. And I'm sorry, Aziz is in Karachi getting married. This is one of his favorite books, and he'll miss the presentation, but I'm sure he's thinking of us. Corbin, as a Frenchman, had an extraordinary capacity, like Mircea Eliade, to affinitize himself with others. It seems that the French have always had this capacity of joining the others. When the French came to North America, they intermarried with the Indians. The British did not. When the French went to Africa, they married with the blacks. The German and the English did not. When the French opened contact with the Sufis, they mingled with the Sufis. And so the most accurate European presentations of these rather occult matters are found in the French. Corban is very much like a 20th century Eliphas Levi. But whereas Eliphas Levi was limited by the 19th century, Corban is unlimited in the way, the mode of the 20th century, to investigate all things all the ways, and not to let a cultural style like the Victorian ethos or the 19th century scientific materialism influence one way or another one's thought. Corban is completely open. And his translation of Ibn Arabi and commentary are to be trusted in the extreme. Now on page 246 of Creative Imagination is the section 5, Man's Prayer and God's Prayer. And the subtitle is The Method of Theophantic Prayer. And Corban uses this term quite accurately, and Ibn Arabi, as well as many of the other forms that we are availing ourselves of. If you're following the Tuesday night, you understand what the process is of theophantic prayer. A theophantic prayer is not what you can say to God, hoping from God an answer in like kind, but it's spiritual. It's more refined than that. It's that there is an exchange to the degree that there is a sharing, that as man prays, God answers immediately, that the form of man's prayer is the form of God's answer. The differentiation capacity of man to articulate what he knows, what he wishes for, what he hopes for, is exactly the form in which the response, the answering of the prayer comes. So that in a theophantic mode, prayer is a sharing between God and man. So that a true prayer would be uttered in such a way that God's answer comes exactly as man prays for. Now the archetype of this in the Christian religion is in the Gospel of Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus says, if you go to a temple to pray out loud, believe me, the answer that you will receive is consonant with that activity. But if you wish to pray to God, pray silently in yourself, in your own monasterian is the Greek term. For God surely knows what you need before you even ask. The form, then, of theophantic prayer, which is made conscious in Ibn Arabi, is a development from the Sermon on the Mount, which itself is absolute archetypal, traditional, high spiritual religion. Notice here that the highest form of prayer is silent without any content. And the true response of God is also in the silence without content. Now, when we come to using Ibn Arabi's Journey to the Lord of Power, we need this background. And so I have brought in here a couple of words with which Corban emphasizes in this section on creative imagination and the Sufism of Ibn Arabi. Chapter 5, Man's Prayer and God's Prayer. And the first, let me read here from Corban, break you into this more gently. Some have thought it paradoxical that prayer should perform a function in a doctrine such as that of Ibn Arabi, and what is more, an essential function, while others have denied that this was so. For those who hasten to classify his doctrine of the transcendental unity of being as monism or pantheism, in the senses these words have assumed in our history of modern philosophy, have made it difficult to understand what function could still be performed by prayer. This is what we shall try to show by speaking of creative prayer. In the light of what has just been disclosed to us, namely that creation equals theophany, that is, theophantic imagination. True, the theophantic structure of being, the relationship which it determines between creator and creature, imply the unity of their being. But this being, which is one in essence, is personalized in two modes of existence, corresponding to its hidden being and to its revealed being. So existence, manifesting from a single essence, comes out into two modes, revealed and hidden, visible and invisible, limited and unlimited. True, the revealed being, and the word here which Ibn Arabi used was zahir, Z-A-H-I-R, zahir, is the manifestation of the hidden. So the revealed being, and the term for manifestation, zuhur, Z-U-H-U-R. So zahir, zuhur, that revealed being and manifestation are assonant. They're very close to each other. It's more than just a poetic synchronicity. It's the fact that in the very refined language which Ibn Arabi uses, that the very process of manifestation is cognate with what is manifested. So that, for instance, the difference between form as a process and content as an essence is not a viable distinction on high energy levels. Only on low energy levels is there a valid distinction. Is there a differentiation which could be trusted? On higher energy levels, the distinction between form and content loosens and finally dissolves and finally disappears. Why? Because form is seen increasingly in its accuracy as process. And the content, which when static, is easy enough to identify, when it's in motion, it's less easy to identify and becomes more affine to the process. So that when you pick up reality and put it into its true mode, its true dynamic, form and content lose their differentiable capabilities. Existence then becomes essence. And Ibn Arabi, very careful always to say, there's only one essence. There is only one essence. But notice that the whole responsibility for discovering this rest with man. Man must learn to pick himself up and put himself in motion. He must learn not to settle for a stodgy categoricalness. That stodgy categoricalness allows one to stumble in this world indefinitely. One nice manifestation of stodgy categoricalness is to consider that continuity of coming on Saturday morning is useless. It's all right to miss. For if one were really lifting yourself in dynamic, one could see that the content of whatever is done gains its affinity to the very process that is being followed by that continuity, that consistency. This turns out, for instance, to be recognizable world round in all religious traditions. For instance, in Greek Orthodox Christianity, there is a form of prayer which is unending. There are, for instance, in the place in the world today where it's practiced most accurately is in the monastery sequences of monasteries in the Mount Athos Peninsula in northern Greece. And continuous prayer. So that whatever one is doing, one is weaving whatever one is doing into a continuity of prayer which is unending. And there have been many wonderful books and articles and treatments of this written in the last 1,500 years that this has been practiced. Well-known technique. The same technique is used in Sufi or in Zen. Why is it used in Zen? Because Zen got it from the late Tang Chinese usage, which came through from the Nestorian Christian influence on Taoism. Before the Nestorian Christian influence, Taoism was indigenously Chinese and not a religion. And after the Western influence came in, it became a religion. The rise of religious Taoism in the 5th century is due to direct influence from the West. If one practices these techniques, any one of them, proficiency in any one of them allows you instantaneous, spontaneous proficiency in any of the others. This is a well-known phenomenon, a well-known fact. For instance, the great American Trappist monk Thomas Merton, who died unfortunately in Bangkok being electrocuted in his bathtub by a fan that fell in, was on his way to have a meeting with the Dalai Lama because Christian Trappist monks were discovering great affinity with the Tibetan meditators because they were practicing the same meditation. And they wanted to discuss how is it that separate traditions, Buddhist and Christian, divided by a whole world and all the cultural differences there are, how is it that we do the same thing? How is that? And of course, we have, in the 20 or so years since that realization came out, come a long way towards understanding that there really is only one form of prayer. There is really only one God. And there's only one form of accurate communication. It's like, no matter how broad the band is, this is broadcasting on every station, on every dial on the band. The shared technique is not that you're tuning to this or that number, but that you're tuning. The process of tuning. And a wonderful phrase from a man who wrote a book about 50 years ago, In Tune with the Infinite, Ralph Waldo Trine, a wonderful, accurate phrase. So here, hidden being and revealed being, zahir is very close to the word for manifestation, zuhir. And the two, the hidden and the revealed, the two form an indissoluble unity. Why is it indissoluble? Why can it not be dissolved? Because the way in which one comes into being is dovetailed in the way into which the other comes into being. They're indissoluble because one never arises without the other. It isn't the bringing of two together. It's not resolving a polarity into a unity. It's transforming the polarity into a complementarity, which is of its true nature a unity. It never was not a unity. So that the transformation is not a reconciliation of opposites. The transformation is a recharacterizing of opposites as complements. Now, if one gets trapped into the Herculean task of trying to transform opposites into a unity, of reconciling opposites into a unity, you have to engage in a rather fruitless competition with the universe for power. You have to have more and more power to do this. It's like the latest news story about fusion energy. If you try to force two positives together to make a unity, it takes almost a supernova type power to do this. But if you transform the opposites into complementaries, you can put some forms of seawater into a container and run a little electric current through it, and it'll work. It's the same way in theophantic prayer. And Ibn Arabi is our guest speaker today. And this was the word that he has for it. So that there is this peculiar sense, and as Corban writes, this idea of a sharing of roles in the manifestation of being is this eternal theophany. The idea of a sharing of roles. God and man share roles together, which cannot be done as long as man is in opposition to God, thinks he is in opposition to God, thinks God is in opposition to him, thinks it's a matter of his power, hopes for a handout, to put it colloquially. That's not it at all. That's pure ignorance. Hopes that, well, I'll hit it lucky. Gambling, that gambling is a spin-off of the belief that there is some kind of a random destiny that can be influenced superstitiously. The inculcation of superstition is a sure sign of ignorance. This idea of a sharing of roles in the manifestation of being in the eternal theophany is fundamental to Ibn Arabi's notion of prayer. It inspires what we have termed his method of prayer, and it makes it a method of theophantic prayer. The notion of sharing presupposes a dialogue between two beings, and this living experience of a dialogical situation, Corban puts this in italics, a dialogical situation. It's a French way of trying to make the language bend out of its normal static designatory reference into a dynamic configuration. He's trying to make a dynamic phrase out of modifying a couple of powerful words. Situation is usually, what have we here? What is the situation? But when a situation is dynamic, it's not what we have here, it's what is focusing itself here that's continuing all over the place, but is focusing itself here. Korban means to say that this dialogical situation is consonant with the way in which Ibn Arabi would understand that prayer, theophantic prayer, is the only dialogic situation that exists. If you're following this, it's not that prayer is one among many, it is the only one. Notice the naive confidence that human beings have around the world, which is quite accurate, that if you could do it right, prayer is all you need. Is an extremely accurate archetypal truth in human beings. All they need is to be taught the right way. What is the right way? Not a doctrine rightness, but the method which has worked for human beings world round for all time, to have it reintroduced. So the notion of sharing presupposes a dialogue between two beings, and this living experience of a dialogical situation confutes any theoretical attempt to reduce the unity of dialogue to an existential monism. To try and reduce it to a one is inappropriate. How does it come back then? What kind of a unity? It isn't a unity of one, it's a unity of zero. Now we come to page 249. As we know, this encounter, this coincidentia oppositorum, is affected on the intermediate plane of imaginative presence. Imaginative presence. What is imaginative presence? The psyche, the realm, the field of psychic energy, imaginative presence. There can be imagination without presence, the mythic realm, but the imagination with presence, the magic realm, is different. Consciousness is self-conscious there. And there are terms for this. All of these have terms. The organ of prayer is the heart, the psycho-spiritual organ with its concentration of energy. The role of prayer is shared between God and man because creation, like theophany, is shared between him who shows himself and him to whom it is shown. This showing is incidentally also technical. And one of the best expressions of it is not in Sufism, but is in one of the great female mystics of the 14th century in the Christian tradition, whose whole book was called Showings, or sometimes it's translated as Revelations of Divine Love. But the true Middle English term is showings. Lady Juliana of Norwich and her book on showings is extremely accurate. All of the women of the 14th century women mystics have an incredible accuracy about them. The male geniuses of Christian mysticism learned from the women. It was the women who were the great teachers in the 14th century. Not only Lady Juliana, a little bit earlier Hadjewitch, and then a little bit later Saint Teresa of Avila. All of them have this uncanny accuracy because of the womanly capacity to understand life as a blending of form and process. And that by understanding that, it's just a slight adjustment to understanding spiritual, theophantic essence. So that once this is understood, we gain an insight into the secret of that inner liturgical action, that inner liturgical action. And those who are coming Tuesday night realize that we're reestablishing here with the Hermetic Wisdom Liturgy, we're reestablishing in a late 20th century Western form that inner liturgical action. We're going to perform it again April 4th here on Tuesday night. So if you're hearing what is being said, it's happening now here. Once understood, we gain an insight into the secret of that inner liturgical action, which Ibn Arabi develops, taking as his text the first surah of the Quran, the one that I opened up with today. The first surah of the Quran, the Fatiha. We witness and participate in an entire ceremonial of meditation. Not ceremony of meditation. It's not the ceremony of meditation. It's the ceremonial ecology of meditating all the way through the various phases to the unity beyond the one. So that the ceremonial is the entire ecology, as we would say today. Not just the ceremony. If it was the ceremony, it would be a ritual. And the best that we could do with a ritual is engender a mythic meaning horizon. That's the very best you can do with a ritual. And the purpose of that mythic meaning horizon is to provide the nourishment, or as the Upanishads would say, the food for the self. To bring it into unity, to bring it into that oneness beyond one. That is all that a ritual can do. You can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. But a true ceremonial with inner presence there is really magic. It's not a ritual that engenders myth. It is a form of self-presentation that manifests the person. And what comes out of a ceremonial presence is the intact person, capable of living out that spirit. And that is quite different. There's a radical difference. As a ritual uses a mask to perform, a true magic religiosity of ceremonial ecology uses presence. And the difference between mask and presence is an astronomical difference. It's a leap in capacity that is exponential beyond anyone's imagination. It's the difference between having a character in a play and having a real person who can take off the costume, take off the mask, and step out of the role into their own life. It's the difference between a comic book and the life you're really living. Is a radical difference. So that here with our example of Ibn Arabi today, we witness and participate in an entire ceremonial of meditation. And then Qurban uses a word here which you'll recognize. The word is meant to be a correlate to an apposition with this phrase, ceremonial of meditation. The word is psalmody, P-S-A-L-M-O-D-Y, psalmody. What is a psalmody? It comes from psalm. What is a psalm? It's a sacred poem, a sacred hymn. Psalmody, the process form of engendering and delivering sacred hymns, sacred poems, psalms. So that the ceremonial of meditation, working with inner presence, is exactly this use of psalmody. A psalmody in two alternating voices. Notice here now, a psalmody in two alternating voices, one human, the other divine. One human, the other divine. That as man speaks, the antiphonal quality, the resonance of meaning, is God's voice. What is God's voice? God's voice in this world comes to us in a spectacular, thunderous silence, to put it in a colloquial image metaphor. So that as we are speaking and enunciating our highest language, we are aware of the silence which articulates each word, each phrase, and more we become attuned to the fact that the silence is also meaningful. Without it, sound would not be able to be articulated in the first place. The very structure of enunciation would not be possible. Any rhetorical patterning would be impossible. So that as man speaks and is aware more and more of the silence, his speech goes more and more into a point to where he speaks his silence in response. And as he does so, God takes his silence and makes words out of it. As man learns to speak the silence of God, God speaks the words of man out of his silence. So that as the sacred hymn goes on, as the sacred psalm goes on, as the sacred poem goes on, it is less and less the human voice that is speaking, and is more and more God speaking these words. The hymn, the psalm, the sacred poem is the vehicle of transformation. It's the crater of the presence. But it's not a mythic language. It's a magical language. It's self-informed. It's radiant from an inner presence. Without that, one is only drawing comic strips, at the best. And children need to draw comic strips. But they need to mature, and they need to come in that maturation to understanding that they have a life to live. And you can take your comic books with you. You don't have to throw them away. But you have to know that this is your life. It's different. So that we witness and participate in an entire ceremonial of meditation, a psalmody in two alternating voices, one human, the other divine. And this psalmody perpetually reconstitutes, recreates the solidarity and interdependence of the Creator and His creature. In each instant, the act of primordial theophany is renewed in this psalmody of the Creator and the creature. But one has to bring a sense of witness. It's almost like the popular fundamentalist Christian big tent revivalist language of the witness self. And the reason why they're so accurate is because they are working on pure archetypal recognizance. There's no intellectual genius at all. There's no cultural sophistication at all. But what there is always that heartfelt need to scrape off any veneer that's there. And if you scrape off most of the veneer, the light will shine through. So that even the most so-called untutored, unsophisticated dedication has its own efficacy. This is why, like in India, there is such a thing as a bhakti yoga. Just a few more minutes and then we'll have our break.